I am here with Mark Lipsitch. Mark, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me. I enjoy your podcast and happy to be on it.
Oh, nice. Well, I am a big fan of the Center for Communicable Disease Dynamics, which is a mouthful, which you run at Harvard. Before we jump into the topic at hand, can you summarize your scientific background?
Sure. I was trained as an evolutionary biologist and mathematical biologist. I'm now an infectious disease epidemiologist and microbiologist. So I've moved sideways a little bit, but the common thread is that I'm very interested in understanding how, when we give people vaccines and antibiotics, how that affects the populations of infectious agents, and then how those changes in the infectious agents affect us and our health. And so I work on how that works, how we measure it, how we measure whether vaccines are doing their job, for example, how we track antibiotic resistance over time, and so forth. And then more recently, I've been involved in two other things. One is the response to the COVID pandemic on a bunch of different fronts. And the other is areas of research policy and research ethics around potentially risky experiments and human challenge trials for COVID vaccines. So I move around a little.
Yeah, well, it's probably been a busy few years for you, I can imagine. This has really been, the entire world came crashing into your wheelhouse somewhere around the beginning of 2020.
Yeah.
Let's start with COVID. I mean, I'm very concerned about the Trump administration's apparent assault on American science and scientific institutions. I want to get there, but let's start with COVID. What did we learn from COVID? What did we learn that we should have learned? What have we imperfectly learned? And what perhaps wrong lessons might we have learned at this point?
Yeah. And I think the other piece is, what did we observe and probably won't learn, even though we should have? There's a whole history of observing lessons and repeating the same mistakes. I think what we learned was a number of things, but one really big one is the importance of public trust and public solidarity in the response to an emergency like COVID. I think that the fact that different parts of the country and different people had very different levels of trust in what the government was telling them, and in the vaccines and before that, the interventions that were put in place to slow the spread, meant that that it was much more divisive than it was in some other places, and that our response was worse. I think we also learned that our public health system needs an upgrade. It was designed in the 19th century at a very hyper-local level, with all the data and all the power really in the states and counties. And that makes it very hard to have a unified national response. And I think we also learned that, and this is one of those things that we sort of relearned, had been already noted a few decades ago, that policies need to be revisited on a regular basis with new information. The information is changing very fast in the middle of a pandemic, and the policies that seemed like a good idea in the past may have lost their value, or we may have more new information that says they weren't actually valuable and we should stop them. And I think an example of that might be, school closure, which looked like the right thing to do. I think it was the right thing to do in the absence of good information. But we learned pretty quickly that young children in particular were not very important in transmission. We learned that those schools that stayed open managed to do so pretty safely. And the policy was kind of stuck in place. And the U.S. was one of the places that that kept schools closed the longest for not very good results and for a lot of damage that did. And that was pretty clear pretty early. But we, for various reasons, kept policies in place past their useful life.
How would you describe the unraveling of institutional trust and actual trustworthiness over the course of the pandemic? I mean, to what degree was the loss of trust warranted? I mean, I think everyone who's on the highly contrarian anti-establishment side at this point has a litany of abuses they can cite, real or imagined abuses, noble lies that we're told, masks don't work and masks, don't grab all the PPE because they're desperately needed for first line responders, but also they masks don't work. You know, try to square those two, that logical contradiction. How would you describe what happened and the challenge of communicating scientific uncertainty to a public in the middle of a global health emergency that the scope of which is still, you're still struggling to understand, and you're messaging into a highly polarized and fragmented information landscape?
Yeah, well, I think we started from a position of very low levels of trust in government among some people and some segments of society, and in public health particularly. Public health has been underfunded for a long time in the United States, and particularly in the least advantaged parts of the country. And so we started from a rough position, and we also started from a level of enormous inequality. And we know that people who were more disadvantaged had worse COVID outcomes within the U.S. And so there was already grounds for polarization. I do think that the early communication from the U.S. government under the first Trump administration was very confusing, and that the promises that it would be over by Easter had no basis in any kind of science and were nonetheless made from the White House. On the other hand, indeed, as you said, there were comments made by people who were trying to induce the behaviors in the population that they thought would be more desirable, and they did come out with comments that were not scientifically valid. And that, of course, undermined trust when they changed, or when people, as you noted, figured out that it actually didn't make logical sense to say, don't use all the PPE, which doesn't work in the first place. So I think there's plenty of blame to go around, but that the system was in bad shape to begin with. And that's something to remember for the future, because the people will largely be different the next time, but the system is going to be very much whatever we make it, or at the moment, however we're breaking it. And seeing the current threats to good science and good public health is pretty worrisome as I think about the future.
Mm. Yeah, well, we'll get to fears of the future, because I share them. What is the appropriate posture and just rhetorical algorithm to be running as a communicator of, you know, public health information in the midst of an epidemic like that, where uncertainty is real and the story is changing, and yet you know that you're getting, you know, clipped into social media and you've got 6 minutes on CNN, and it's an environment that's hostile to nuance. It's hostile to uncertainty on the part of the so-called experts. The very role of an expert is being undermined by perceived failures of expertise. And unfortunately, scientific uncertainty, while it is often the only sane thing to confess in the midst of a conversation about the science, when you're confessing it on the news, you're, at least to many people's ears, you're failing to function in the political role that is also part of the communication of science during an emergency, right? So you're giving advice to the public, and when the story changes, or when the story is always a probabilistic one, like you think something may be benefit, but you're not sure, and you're aware that the stories might change, how will you want to walk that tightrope next time? Because clearly, during COVID, that just the communication burden and the failure to meet that burden was just unbearable at a certain point. I mean, we had a society that shattered over the perceived failure of expertise in the midst of this pandemic. It's so much so, I mean, the shattering is a little bit of a cartoon, but it's not too far from what's true. We had half of our society that was absolutely terrified of COVID and desperate to get vaccinated at the first opportunity. I mean, I waited in the dark at 4 a.m. to get, you know, possible overflow vaccines in a ghetto in my city. And yet the other half of the country thought COVID was more or less a non-issue. It was the flu, but they were terrified to get vaccinated. And that division remained in some sense, it still remains, right?
Still remains, yep.
Again, how would you, as someone who's trying to give an honest account of the best information insofar as you have it, you know, hour by hour during a pandemic, meet this challenge of communicating nuance and uncertainty in the current environment? Because I just think we obviously failed somehow last time, and there has to be some rhetorical device that authorities can arm themselves with so as to inoculate people against their conspiracy thinking and their waiting of when the story changes. That's how science is done, right? It's not, there's nothing nefarious about the story changing in principle. And yet every time the story changed, it was perceived to be to the absolute discredit, the everlasting discredit of scientific institutions.
Yeah, I think it's a great set of questions you ask. And it's not hypothetical. At the Center for Communicable Disease Dynamics at the Harvard Chan School, we ran 150 plus Zoom-based press conferences during the course of the pandemic to try to do exactly what you're saying, to try to lay out what was known and what was not known. But I think from the perspective of government spokespeople and experts, this is something that really has to start between, during peacetime, during a period when people are hearing about, you know, beach safety and avoiding heat stroke and sort of more routine things. And it has to become clear that science evolves. Most science doesn't evolve as fast as pandemic science. And so it is a special time during a pandemic. But when there's a new outbreak of something that's not understood, experts can say, look, this is what we think it is. These are the precautions we're taking because we think it may be these things. And we're going to keep updating and we're going to keep refining what we know and then changing our recommendations as we understand it better or as the situation changes or both. And I think people do that in their normal lives all the time. You know, weather forecasts are use science, and people are perfectly capable of understanding that as you track a storm, you update what you think about it. They don't say that the weather forecasters are wafflers or incompetent. We sometimes do think they wish they were more on the ball, but we know that it's a probabilistic game. I think people are actually smarter and more able to deal with these kinds of things than they're often given credit for, but they have to be treated as adults and be used to it during peacetime and during periods when they aren't also under incredible stress from the pandemic itself. The leader of Singapore actually set an extraordinary example. He did a Facebook Live post or session in February of 2020 as the pandemic was starting and had come to Singapore already. And he got on Facebook Live and said, this is what we know. We went through SARS-1 in the past and we have learned some lessons from that because they were very hard hit by the original SARS in 2003. He said, this is what we know. This is what we're doing. We're going to change what we do and what we know as the situation changes. And it was very straightforward, all in very clear language. And, you know, I think we have a lot to learn from that performance. And it's not something that a lot of public health officials are comfortable doing. I think there are also ways to build it into the system. Up until the end of last month, I was part of setting up a new center within the CDC called the Center for Forecasting and Outbreak Analytics. And one of the things that we really tried to do there when designing our public communications was to have a regular update. When there was a crisis going on, we would set a regular pattern of updating what we said so that people would expect that and wouldn't think that was some kind of emergency if there was a new statement, because there was a new statement on some regular schedule. And also, it would be expected that those updates would come. And so if for some reason it didn't come, there would be a demand for it, and that would insulate against potentially political interference. So I think there are ways to do that. That's something the UK really has pioneered in their public health communications and do very well. And so I think building in regular updates of data, building in expiration dates for policy decisions and public health guidance, where you say, this is our interim decision or guidance until, say, 30 days or 90 days, and then we're going to revisit it, helps to unstick the process and avoid the kind of policy stickiness that really caught us, made our policies worse during COVID. And that's an old lesson. There's a great book by Harvey Fineberg and Richard Neustadt on the swine flu affair when we vaccinated millions of Americans against swine flu in 1976 after three cases. And then that never became a thing. And we had a number of adverse effects. And their number one recommendation was to make sure that policies have off-ramps. And that's an example of one of those lessons that we should have already had in our back pocket, but we didn't quite.
Why do you think vaccines are so uniquely terrifying and polarizing? I mean, it seems that people who are, you know, highly radicalized by vaccines and their use and their mandates and their et cetera, aren't radicalized by similarly or even more, you know, even riskier medical interventions, right? I mean, you had the spectacle of people who wouldn't take the COVID vaccine under any circumstances and would have gone to their deathbeds praising themselves for not having taken it. And yet they'll sign up for something that is the safety of which is far less demonstrated. And I mean, even something that's like a therapeutic for COVID. I mean, I know people who wouldn't get vaccinated for COVID, but the moment they got COVID, they got, you know, monoclonal antibodies pumped into them and a bunch of other cocktails just on the chance that it would mitigate the illness. This was early on when it was still an illness that people reasonably feared. What is it about vaccines, in your view?
Yeah, I think monoclonal antibodies are also quite safe, but putting that aside.
But I mean, tens of millions of people hadn't taken them for COVID at this point. Yeah.
So I think one part of the answer is that there is a sophisticated and widespread campaign to try to make people scared of vaccines, which has been led in the past by the man who's now our Secretary of Health and Human Services. And we shouldn't put that aside, that some people have an interest in making radicalization about vaccines. And why that is, we could speculate about. I don't actually understand, but it is a fact.
I think that is just also my question, right? It's like, so they're doing it for vaccines in a way that they're not doing it for other medical interventions. And this is just another way of stating the question. Like, what is so scary about vaccines? To give you just a shade of an answer that I have rattling around my brain, it might have something to do with the fact that we give them to healthy children, right? Like, it's not like your child is sick and you have to do something to get him or her well. It's your child's healthy, and now you're sticking a needle into, in many cases, an infant who can't even understand what's happening. That's disturbing. And the idea that there's some risk of a bad effect, which is real, that's somehow intolerable, right?
I think that's true, but I think that is part of the story. On the other hand, as you said, there are a lot of things that are more dangerous, much more dangerous in reality than vaccines are. And yes, I think as a matter of human psychology, it is more natural to people to intervene when there is an immediate problem, so an illness to treat, rather than to prevent. It's just part of human nature, as best I understand human nature. But I also think we shouldn't discount the fact that people have chosen to make this a toxic issue, to use perhaps the wrong word, an issue that is polarizing and that where fear is being instilled for no good reason. I think the susceptibility to that fear might have something to do with what you said, but we shouldn't overlook the fact that this is a big industry.
So what should we believe about COVID and COVID vaccines at this point? Maybe we can do this kind of rapid fire. Yeah. I'll tell you what's in my head, and you can debunk the myths and half truths that have gotten there. Perhaps I imagine that I know that something like 1.1 million Americans died from COVID, and probably, I think this is due to still mathematical modeling, but something like 300,000 people died who didn't need to die, based as a result of vaccine hesitancy. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, I think the numbers are a little bigger on the number who died, but that's the right order of magnitude.
Mm-hmm. Is there any reason to be more concerned about the risks associated with mRNA vaccines as a class of vaccines than ordinary vaccines? And is there something riskier about COVID vaccines than the other vaccines that people routinely take?
On COVID, no. It's a new virus, so we are learning about the safety as hundreds of millions of people get it. but we've learned a lot because hundreds of millions, billions of people have now gotten these vaccines. Mm. mRNA is a new technology. It's understandable that people find it unfamiliar and have questions about it. But the data show that these mRNA vaccines against COVID are extremely safe. They are not 100% without side effects. There are side effects. Those have been documented. It's also clear that in the presence of COVID circulating SARS-CoV-2 or COVID virus, it is a good trade-off to take the risk of side effects for most people compared to the risk of that it protects you from getting COVID and its complications.
How do you think about the risks for specific groups like teenage boys? I mean, I think that was the one cohort where it seemed like there was real signal of myocarditis risk that was looking like in that group, maybe it was a toss-up as to whether or not they should get vaccinated given the risks on both sides. I don't know what the current thinking is there, but it seemed like it was you were not completely irrational to think maybe my teenage son does not need the COVID vaccine given how benign the disease tends to be in kids that age and the elevated risk for boys for whatever reason.
Yeah, I think that's not irrational. And I think people who make that decision or whose kids make that decision with them when they're teenagers are making an understandable decision. We had we have girls, but we would have had our teenagers vaccinated had that been who we had as children, because had we had boys, because the myocarditis, while real, was not very severe in most cases. It went away. And the small risk of really severe COVID and long COVID, which there's growing evidence that vaccines help with as well, would have been enough in our minds. But I think people, that's part of treating people like adults, is there are ways to reasonably disagree. And I don't begrudge anybody who makes the opposite decision of that for that group of people. I think as you get to age groups or groups of people like pregnant women who are at very high risk or comparatively high risk of complications, that decision becomes harder to justify based on numbers and really a matter of being opposed to vaccination more generally. And that I think is very hard to understand, but it's certainly something that some people, a view that some people hold and that needs to be discussed with them, with their doctors and figured out.
What about now that the disease has evolved to be more benign, how do you view the risk reward of vaccination? I mean, so speaking personally, I told you that I was waiting in the dark at 4 a.m. hoping to get an early vaccine. Now, for the last, I think, at least 2 years, I don't think I've been vaccinated because I've gotten COVID more or less on schedule once a year. And that, in my mind, has served as my vaccination for that year. How preposterous is that road to personal health?
The value of vaccination as opposed to becoming infected to build immunity is that the risk of long COVID is not there. The risk of, although low, of severe illness is not there from the vaccine. And it is from COVID, even though the probabilities are low. So it's an understandable decision. I think you could improve your odds a little bit of certainty of staying healthy by periodic COVID vaccination, but it is not the same kind of public health emergency that it was in years past. And so I think, you know, people will have different views, and that's certainly true in the numbers, that the numbers of people getting vaccinated has gone down. Part of the main reason why it appears to be a more mild illness is that we have a lot of immunity in the population, both from previous infections and from multiple rounds of vaccination. So some of it is the evolution of the virus, but
yeah,
there aren't very many people around to test this hypothesis on. But my prediction would be that if you magically made the entire population susceptible again and removed their immunity, there would be a lot of severe COVID around. It's just that the combination of host immunity and a little bit of the evolutionary changes has combined to make it rarer that people get severe illness.
So again, just taking my personal case, and people can draw whatever lesson they can draw from it. So if I get the flu vaccine every year, because that's what I do, and it's a new flu every year, and I'm not getting the COVID vaccine, do you detect any cognitive dissonance there? I mean, in my own mind, the rationale is, I remember every time I got the COVID vaccine, it actually seemed like I had fairly significant side effects. I mean, I felt crappy for at least 24 hours. So it seemed like more of a vaccine than a flu vaccine, which I never perceive an effect from. And that's really just the source of my bias. If you were me, would you be getting a COVID vaccine every year and a flu vaccine every year? And that would be the rational way to have a sane approach to
it? I think so. I mean, these are not the same kinds of truly life and death decisions that they were when the vaccines first came out and when COVID was a bigger threat. So, you know, I'm not going to spend a lot of time trying to convince you one way or the other, but the COVID vaccines are also probably more effective than the flu vaccines on the whole. And so, you pay a bigger price and you get somewhat more protection.
So on balance, are we any better prepared for the next pandemic, or do you think we're worse off for this dress rehearsal we experienced during COVID?
I would say that was a performance. It wasn't just a dress rehearsal.
Well, I guess it was a dress rehearsal for something far worse. But
something even worse.
Yeah.
I think the fraying of public trust in the United States and in some other countries puts us in a worse position. I think that some of the Supreme Court decisions putting limits on what public health can do put us in a worse position. I think that improvements in data, although modest, put us in a slightly better position. We have better ways of knowing what's going on through wastewater and other modest improvements in how we get data, although that's still very fragmented. I think that the Center for Forecasting and Outbreak Analytics that I mentioned earlier that we set up at CDC puts us in a much better position to understand what the impacts of interventions and of guidance will be, and to forecast what the potential courses of outbreaks will be. And that's been proven in Mpox and in the later part of COVID and in other situations. So I think it's a mix, but I think, you know, the United States was listed as the most pandemic ready country by one of the rating exercises. And we certainly were not one of the best performers. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of it comes down to leadership and public trust.
Yeah. I mean, one of the points on which public trust frayed was in a discussion of the origins of the virus. What are your views about the origins of COVID, and is there anything like a scientific consensus at this point?
I don't think that anybody knows. I think there are lots of opinions, and that there is no definitive evidence that it came from the market, and there is no definitive evidence that it came from a lab. There's circumstantial evidence on both sides, not very compelling circumstantial evidence. And I think that it was unfortunate that there was a premature rush to say that it was definitely of a natural origin, which doesn't mean that that's wrong. It means that we didn't have the evidence then, and I still think we don't have the evidence now. And I think different people weight circumstantial evidence differently, and that's normal. So a lot of people are sort of repeating whatever their prior beliefs were. If they thought that science labs are dangerous, they tend to be in favor of the lab leak hypothesis. And if they thought that zoonoses or outbreaks from animals are the way that outbreaks mostly happen, then those people tend to favor the natural origin. But I think I'm totally happy to have a conversation with anybody who's unsure and has a strong hunch. But I think anybody who says they're sure is misunderstanding what the evidence says.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, happily, you're talking to somebody who's worried both about lab leaks and about virus hunting and proximity to vectors. So how do you think about that? Let's take the lab leak and the kind of the engineering side of things first. How concerned are you about the safety of labs and the work that is going on in those labs? I mean, let's talk about gain of function research as well here. I mean, what is gain of, what are we doing in labs? What is gain of function research? What is a justification for it? And what are your concerns?
So gain of function research of concern or enhancement of potential pandemic pathogens are two terms that are used sometimes to refer to what I think colloquially is probably best described as research that carries pandemic risk. And what that means is research where, because of the type of infectious agent that people are working with or creating through modifications in the lab, there is a risk that infectious agent, usually a virus, could cause a very large outbreak or a pandemic if it infected a laboratory worker or someone else and then began to spread. There have been a set of studies that meet that criterion. I think most people would agree. Some of the most famous ones were the enhancement of avian flu, H5N1 flu, to be transmissible in ferrets. That happened in the mid-2010s. And before that, there was recreation of the 1918 virus. More recently, there have been some modifications of coronaviruses and other things. The justifications for doing this are essentially scientific knowledge, and that we might be able to learn something important that would help us in the future. I think many of those scientific justifications are hard to sustain on very careful examination for various reasons that we could get into. And the risk is that either through accidental release or infection, or in some cases through deliberate misuse, if someone took the information or took the stocks of the modified viruses and deliberately infected people with them for ill-intentioned reasons, we could have an outbreak that potentially would be very large, particularly for viruses where there's little immunity in the population and they are readily transmitted between humans. So in the mid-2010s, when those first those H5N1 experiments came out, I helped to start a group called the Cambridge Working Group that called for and eventually succeeded in convincing the U.S. government to put a moratorium on funding those kinds of experiments until some careful risk-benefit analysis was done. There's been a lot of back and forth, and the pandemic interrupted it. There was a, I think, quite good policy position at the end of the Biden administration that was to go into effect this year. And then right before it went into effect, the Trump administration created its own policy, which in many ways did many of the things that we were hoping for, even some of the things the Biden administration hadn't done, like putting controls on experiments that were not funded by the U.S. government.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time when that came out in May, I said that had this come from an administration that wasn't attacking science in other ways, I would have been 95% supportive. But in the current context, I was nervous that it would be misapplied. And just a few days ago, the NIH released a list of grants and projects, some of them internal to NIH, that were stopped under this new executive order from May of this year. And many of them are clearly experiments that hold little, if any, actual pandemic risk, that were doing good things for global health and for public health and for science. And so, unfortunately, those fears have come true that this has been sort of a hammer in search of a nail rather than a carefully crafted policy to try to make us safer.
So what is the justification for gain-of-function research? I mean, so naively, when I look at this, given how quickly we can sequence the genome of a novel virus, and given how quickly we now can spin up vaccines with mRNA technology, what is the benefit? I guess this question is both for gain-of-function research. It's also, this question is the same question I have for virus hunting. You know, why go into a cave with bats and look for viruses as yet unencountered that have pandemic potential when in 24 hours, the moment a pandemic starts, within 24 hours, we can sequence the genome of the offending virus. And in a few short hours after that, or days, or at most weeks, it seems we can start producing vaccines. Even if you're arguing that this gives us some kind of head start, it gives us a head start of days. And with all the attendant risk, why do either of those two things? Go meet the bats and see what they're infected with, and or bring some of those viruses into the lab and give them greater infectious potential for human cells?
There's a lot in that question. So let me break it down. So
please.
The first thing I would say is I think I basically share your conclusions, but not all of your premises.
Mm-hmm.
The premise that we can invent a working vaccine in a matter of days is a good description of what happened in the case of COVID-19. That built on decades of research on SARS-1, on the MERS coronavirus, on the more or less unrelated virus called RSV, where scientists had figured out ways of which parts of these viruses were most important for creating vaccines and ways to stabilize the relevant structures. That's where the RSV story came in. So the fact that we were dealing with a close relative of a known virus meant that that was possible within days. That wouldn't necessarily be the case for something completely unknown. In fact, it probably wouldn't be the case. There would have to be work done to figure out what might be the best antigen for a vaccine. So there is some value to knowing what's out there beyond, well, for the purposes of developing vaccines.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's the virus hunting piece, right? Not the gain of function piece.
Correct.
Yeah.
So the gain of function, I mean, I disagree with all of what I'm about to say, but what the gain of function proponents say is that their work allows us to make vaccines more readily, that it tells us what to look for when we see viruses in nature. Those are their main justifications. And the main reason I think they're wrong about that is that we haven't developed any vaccine. You don't need to know how a virus transmits in order to make a vaccine. We have never known how any virus transmits at the level of detail that those studies involve at the time when we made the first vaccine. So it's just not what you need for vaccine manufacture. And for the surveillance part, the issue is that knowing what to look for in one viral background could be very different from even a very closely related virus, because mutations are not independent of one another in their activity. So knowing that a particular change matters to transmission is only relevant very locally. And we have lots of good examples of that in studies of flu virus, for example.
Right.
On the virus hunting front, with a Harvard undergraduate, Aishani Atresh, we have a paper coming out in a few weeks. There's a preprint of it already out that goes through the case for virus hunting in terms of vaccine development and asks whether any of the premises of that case are true and comes up with a really negative answer. So we point out that we haven't been able to find most of the reservoirs, even of things that we know infect people, or many of the things that we know infect people. We point out that the discovery of animals infected with new viruses has never in the history to date prompted the development of new vaccines against those agents. It's only when there is an outbreak, and sometimes even an outbreak in rich Westerners, that we try to do serious vaccine development. And we go through other parts of the argument as well and show that, at least for the purpose of vaccine development, virus hunting has not been a valuable activity. I think there is some baseline level of needing to know what's out there, but we have 26 viral families in the world, approximately, that infect humans. And for about 10 of those, we have no vaccine against any member of the viral family. So we've got lots of work to do without finding new candidates. We should keep some baseline level of looking, but there are better ways to do that, mainly through looking at what infects people.
Why do we have such effective vaccines for certain pathogens and seemingly no hope of getting there for others? Is it simply just a matter of how frequently that virus mutates, or is there another pitfall here?
It's a great question, and it's one of those things that people discuss at scientific meetings over drinks, and everybody has a hypothesis, and it's hard to distinguish. What I would say is that my hypothesis would be that when there's an infection that our bodies know how to fight off the first time they're infected and develop a long-term, long-lasting, highly effective immune response, those infections, by and large, are ones for which we have good vaccines. Measles is the most perfect example of that, but almost all the childhood infections, they're childhood infections for a reason. They infect children once, and then those children rarely get it again. In the case of measles, essentially never get it again. So for those infections, we figured out ways to do what the natural infection does and produce a really good immune response. What's much harder is infections like HIV, where people have been trying very, very hard for a long time, but the natural immune response is not incredibly effective. And also the virus itself attacks the immune system, making it even harder. Gonorrhea is another good example. There's been a lot of work to try to make a gonorrhea vaccine, and infection with gonorrhea doesn't produce lasting immunity. And we've basically been unable to develop a gonorrhea vaccine, although there's interesting evidence that a vaccine against meningitis caused by a very closely related bacterium may have some impact on gonorrhea.
Hmm. So let's pivot to our current circumstance with the second Trump administration and what many have characterized as an assault on science and scientific institutions. Last I looked, the American Association for the Advancement of Science claimed that the 2026 budget will reduce our funding of basic research by at least a third, and that we'll be spending less on basic research than we have any year this century. I'm sure that's probably adjusted for inflation. That detail alone is shocking. I mean, there are other specific details, like the funding for the NSF is cut by up to 50%, perhaps a little more. And again, this is not the defunding of so-called woke programs like critical race theory or gender studies. We're talking about basic research here. We're talking physics, chemistry, biology, computer science. You know, to my eye, this seems like a, you know, perhaps ideologically driven or just personality driven assault on the very engine of American leadership and innovation, more or less guaranteed to harm our society. One could wonder why any administration would be tempted to do this, given that they're not even paying lip service at this point to reining in the deficit or debt. I mean, the current budget balloons the debt over 10 years by something like $3 or $4 trillion, and that yet this stuff is being cut. How do you view what the current administration is doing with respect to science? And obviously, there's been direct animosity expressed toward Harvard, where the institution you're associated with. What's going on in the ivory tower now and in basic research? And how do you interpret what the Trump administration is doing and what are its likely consequences?
I think the word assault is the right word. It's on so many different fronts. I mean, it's the budget cuts you describe are devastating and will reduce economic activity, will harm the ecosystem in which private industry, academia, and non-governmental organizations are working in often together, often in competition, but to try to innovate and bring new ideas out. The estimate is that every dollar that the NIH spends produces $2.50 plus of economic activity. So it's a direct hit on the economy. But beyond the funding cuts, there's also an attack on foreign students and foreign trainees who are essential to our labs and to keeping them staffed, because we have a growing scientific enterprise and it needs trained people. And we train a lot of our own people. And we also have become an incredibly attractive place for people from overseas to come and get more training and contribute to the enterprise. And that strengthens us. I mean, the connections that we had to China during the early days of COVID allowed us to figure out what was going on in Wuhan much more quickly and warn the world. That was a project that we did in our group. And there are so many other advantages to building human connection through scientific exchange. So that's being assaulted. The placement of disinformation experts or unqualified people in charge of scientific and medical agencies, such as the Secretary of Health and Human Services, who's a well-known anti-vaccine activist who has brought his activism directly with no scientific basis to that department. We have a reality TV star in charge of NASA. The substitution of politicized disinformation for real science in the leadership positions in our government is going to further undermine public trust, as it should. I mean, we should not trust what comes from the mouth of our Secretary of Health and Human Services. And increasingly, he's trying to destroy trust at lower levels as well. Then there's the assault on global health, which is a sort of cousin of the science that we do and very intermingled with it. And
what DOGE did to USAID.
The cuts to AID, USAID, to the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief, PEPFAR, and to a number of overseas research grants. So a group at our at our institution at Harvard Chan School of Public Health has been working with the with groups in Botswana for a couple of decades now, several decades, on HIV research and treatment. They've had to lay off hundreds of people and cancel, due to the cancellation of, I think, 11 grants, maybe even more than that, to study ways to combat HIV in sub-Saharan Africa. And just as an example of the kinds of benefits that American citizens get, the group that works, that the center that Harvard University set up in collaboration with the Botswana government, was the group that first identified the Omicron variant of COVID-19 and was able to warn the world, followed soon also with the South Africans. And, you know, these are, global health is all about interconnection and the fact that diseases transmit across boundaries. So all of these efforts being undermined are really to the detriment of Americans as well as to the rest of the world. And then the last thing I would say is that cancellations of grants that are in progress, either because they're at Harvard, where essentially all federal grants, virtually all federal grants have been canceled, or based on some kind of ideological reason at other institutions, those cancellations mean that the sort of efforts of scientists are just wasted. We can't both figure out how we're going to accommodate the next month of salaries without any money and also keep our science going. You can't do both of those at the same time effectively. And the level of uncertainty that has sort of clouded the scientific community is really destructive and really wasteful. It's putting a lot of people whose minds could be doing much more valuable things in the position of being essentially accountants, forensic accountants, figuring out how we're going to survive till the next month and keep people employed.
So how do you interpret the motive for this? Or what, I mean, what is the, I mean, there's been some stated motives, but they're, I guess they're not entirely coherent. I mean, why do you think this is the policy of the Trump administration?
It's hard to say. The stated motives from the vice president and from individuals who are now in the Department of Education, who wrote about their plans to stick it to Harvard and Columbia in December, are that these are institutions that should be brought down, that they don't like them and they should be brought down. And
I mean, so maybe I can give a little more color to this. See, I'm very sympathetic to the criticism that Harvard and the other, you know, august institutions of higher learning in this country have been captured to a degree that many of us were right to worry about, and in the aftermath of October 7th, were right to be appalled by a left-wing ideology that has just, you know, spun their moral compass in all the wrong directions. So there's, you know, there's a level of anti-Semitism expressed, there's a level of confusion about the reasons to defend Western values, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of confusion on the Quad, especially on the kind of humanities side of the Quad, that people are right to be worried about and are right to want to figure out how to apply pressure to for some course correction. Right now, I've got, you know, very strong free speech concerns. So I think more or less any bad idea should be expressible in a university campus and in a seminar, and you should be able to talk about anything. And, you know, we should have endless tolerance for the expression of bad ideas. But when you're talking about disrupting the mission of a university campus with protests and bullying people from just one religion, not letting them enter buildings, you know, spitting in people's faces when they're trying to go to a lecture hall, or when they're coming out of it, not letting lectures happen because you're effectively vetoing this event as a heckler, right? All of that becomes completely non-functional and, you know, in many cases, morally despicable. And I think a lot of these students who are protesting should have been kicked out of school, not given, you know, awards for social activism as they were in certain cases. I mean, this is now going back to the ordeal that we all saw the Nicholas Christakis go through in the Quad at Yale back in the day. There was an unraveling of kind of moral sanity in so much of the university for so many years. I mean, starting at around 2014, that it reached a tipping point post October 7th, where you have people, you know, on the day after lining up explicitly with Hamas, you know, before Israel had done anything in response. And so this was just a crisis that it's of ideas that it's easy to see the Trump administration felt it needed to respond to, but it is responding in a way that makes absolutely no sense, right? It's, I mean, again, to take the narrow case here, there's two pieces. You're defunding basic research, right? Again, not I completely understand the people who would say, you know, anything related to gender studies or critical race theory or any of these other ideologically captured parts of the institution, we're not funding that anymore. I mean, whether or not that's the right response or not, we could debate, but at least that would be intelligible. But to be going after chemistry and biology and physics and, you know, medical research that is mission critical for responding to the next pandemic, to be, you can understand the chaos at the southern border and the gaslighting there, you know, getting people to be concerned about immigration, right? I get the response of the Trump administration, all of that has in the main been disastrous and needlessly polarizing and ruinous for people who have been adding nothing but value to our society. But leaving that aside, you can understand how immigration is a thing, is a bright, shiny object that half the country is really exercised about. What I can't understand is why you would want to no longer attract the best and brightest from all over the world to get their PhDs here and then to start their companies here, to do their basic research here. Why you would want to alienate those people, which seems to be exactly what is happening, and, you know, all too predictably based on these policies. So do you have any hypothesis as to why the policy is so obviously self-destructive to the very engine of wealth creation and security for this country?
There's a lot there too. I would start by saying that I think that that whatever one believes about the responses on campus to October 7th and the buildup of ideologies before that, and I think I don't go quite as far as you, although I have some sympathy for some of the points you made. Whatever one thinks about that, it's just implausible that that has anything to do with the real motives. I mean, Donald Trump loves a lot of anti-Semites and cavorts with them and invites them to Mar-a-Lago. He pardoned some very unsavory people who were January 6th rioters. He praised them following Charlottesville. I mean, the idea that this is about anti-Semitism beggars belief. So I think just putting that aside as a plausible motive, it is certainly the case that there has been some bad things happening on campuses and bad handling of it by some campus leaders. But that is not really what underlies this. I think, I don't know how to speculate about what the real motives are, but I think it is an attempt to destroy bastions of what are seen as resistance to an authoritarian government and universities. It's the standard playbook. You attack the universities, you attack the journalists, you attack the other centers of independent thought. And that's how you attack the judiciary. That's how you consolidate power. So that's my best explanation, which has the benefit of being historically consistent with how others have done it and doesn't require one to actually believe the nonsense that the real motivation for this is fighting anti-Semitism, which it just can't be.
Yeah, I mean, I basically agree with that, except it's easy to see how some people, again, I mean, there's so many actors here and so many influences that it's a little hard to generalize, but some people are highly allergic to the anti-Semitism they see on the left, and for some strange reason that I can't understand, not at all allergic to the anti-Semitism that comes from the right. And so while I don't have a good theory of mind about how you become such a person, I have met such people, right? They're only concerned about the tipping over on the left into Marxist identitarian moral panics and, always seem to ground out at hating the Jews. You hate white people, but Jews are classed as white people over on the left. They're extra white. They're extra privileged. They have no intersectional points at all. where no matter how embattled they are and no matter what the history is there.
Yeah.
Whereas over on the right, Jews are not considered white by the white supremacists, and they're demonized for an altogether different set of reasons. But some people just care about what happens on the left. And I think the people who are not allergic to Trump and see no authoritarian threat or pretend to see no authoritarian threat in his regime, they think it's totally plausible that you would beat the shit out of Harvard right now because of how, and other Ivy League institutions, just because of that performance in front of Congress by the three college presidents and how tongue-tied they were over the problem of anti-Semitism on their campus. Because we all know that had there been people in the Quad calling for the deaths of Black people or you know, spitting in the faces of Black people or doing the same for trans people, the administrations wouldn't have tolerated that for 15 seconds, and yet they had endless patience for the greatest eruption of anti-Semitism we've seen in our lifetime in America. And that double standard was intolerable. And so there are a lot of, you know, conservative Jews, right-of-center Jews, who, given a forced choice between an extension of the Biden administration under Harris and Trump, they went all in for Trump for this very reason, and they see no moral or psychological discordance there.
Yeah, I won't argue with you. I mean, this is not something I know anything about. And I will agree with you that, you know, the U.S. government funds science because it sees correctly that science creates value for the country.
Yeah.
It doesn't always do it quickly. It doesn't always do it predictably for each individual study. But as a collective activity, we as a country benefit from being the leaders in innovation, the leaders in new discoveries, the leaders in new products, and the leaders in being a place where foreign scientists and others want to come to train. And that has nothing to do with individual institutions, or very little to do with individual institutions, and everything to do with the value of the collective enterprise.
Hmm.
And to take major leading institutions that you disagree with on some other topic and punish them by destroying the American investment in their scientific work is self-destructive, not productive.
Yeah. I think Fareed Zakaria just made this point. In our, you know, growing superpower conflict with China, our advantage has been, China, you know, obviously has a much larger population. It's pulling from something like 1.4 billion people to find its scientific talent. Many of the biggest or the most esteemed and productive research universities on Earth now are Chinese, and the names of which I don't even know. But up until yesterday, practically, America's been able to pull not just from our population of, you know, 340 million, we've been pulling from the entire world, including China, right? We've had a population of 8 billion people to recruit from, the best and brightest from. And we seem to have just stopped that overnight. How much harm to that recruitment has been done by these recent paroxysms in our approach to immigration and just frank and all too well publicized mistreatment of immigrants in our country?
I think it's very clear that many, many really bright and eager to contribute scientists are going to go elsewhere if they can possibly find a better place to do it. And we will be the poorer for it. I don't have numbers on it yet. I have a lot of individual anecdotes of people who are thinking very hard about where they can find a job that doesn't put them at risk of not being able to get back in the country or of being discriminated against. So it's going to be ugly. How ugly and what the sort of domino effects will be remains to be seen, but it's very counterproductive.
Mm. All right, Mark, final question. What pandemic threat keeps you up at night at this point? What are you most worried about, and what aren't we doing that we should be doing at this point to prepare for a future in which, whether by our own misadventures in the lab or by the hand of nature, pandemics far more dangerous and destructive than COVID get hurled at us?
I kind of have a two-part answer. I mean, I think in terms of something that isn't currently very bad and could get bad, flu remains the biggest the biggest candidate, and the spread of H5N1 flu in birds and mammals, and the seeming, particularly in the United States, and the seeming inability to get a real handle on that due to a number of reasons, including the decentralized public health system we have, is extremely worrying. I think the pandemic that we had control of and that we were helping to bring to an end is the HIV pandemic. And I think I'd like to end there, because by disinvesting in efforts to treat and prevent HIV in large parts of Africa and other parts of the world, we are just giving up on something where we were really succeeding, and where new types of prophylactic drugs were being developed that really could had the prospect of being almost like vaccines. And by disinvesting in that, and by disinvesting more broadly in vaccines and other things in the rest of the world, we're just like giving back for free a lot of gains against pandemic and epidemic diseases that we already had control of. And that to me is in some ways even more scary, because it's so obviously self-destructive.
Well, it's also just so cruel. I mean, we don't perceive it as self-destructive if we've got the America First update to our firmware that is spreading all too fast in our society. But it's just so appalling and obscene. I mean, you know, this is a lot of this lies directly with Elon and his kind of ruthless and scarcely sane approach to, you know, his tenure and not in office, but office adjacent with Doge and his team of teenagers and incels ransacking the place. I mean, I've heard what seem to be credible estimates that some hundreds of thousands of people have probably lost their lives as a result of what's already happened to USAID. I mean, that sounds insane on its face, but then I think when I picture the details of just stopping life-saving treatment to people, you know, mostly kids with HIV or tuberculosis or malaria, or people with diarrheal illness, and you just stop rehydration therapy because all of a sudden there's no more funds for it. I can imagine people die very, very quickly. And I've seen, you know, multiple, more or less all the press I've seen on this have reported something like 300,000 deaths estimated already, and most of those being children, and predicting something like 1 million deaths unless we quickly pivot here. And these are all preventable deaths. So this is just a, you know, something akin to a moral atrocity. And it was done effectively on X, right? I mean, you got Elon feeding USAID gleefully into the wood chipper by his account on X, you know, over a weekend. And this is the result. Do I have my facts straight there? I mean, is that how you perceive what happened?
That's my understanding as well. But, and when I said self-destructive, I meant as humans, not as Americans only.
Yeah.
So I maybe need to get the firmware update, but haven't gotten it yet.
No, well, you just have to anticipate how insulated and callous so much of our society has grown, under current conditions. Well, Mark, thank you for bringing some clarity here to the podcast, and for all that you're doing on the pandemic preparedness front. I guess just a final question is, what can private people do to help here? If our government is pulling back from its commitment to sanely preparing for a risky future, is there anything that private citizens can give money to that is effective at this point? I know, and I should say, I mean, if you're at all sheepish about shilling for your own projects here, I know we've supported your center at Harvard, the Center for Communicable Disease Dynamics, before, and I don't know if you normally take piecemeal funding from the public or just large grants, but I'll give a link at the bottom of these show notes and with the relevant email here, so people can support your work.
Thank you. What is
it they can support in your efforts, and what else do you recommend that people support at this point?
So at the Center for Communicable Disease Dynamics at Harvard Chan School of Public Health, we are trying to train the next generation of public health leaders to do very high quality and very sophisticated work in infectious disease research. The cost of each graduate student is a couple of $100,000 to get them through their program. And our training grant was one of the grants that was canceled by the Trump administration in its wholesale cancellation of grants to Harvard. So we have an acute need for support for our doctoral students, our PhD students, to get them through and to take new students to keep the pipeline going. And those students go on to become researchers at universities. They go on to become leading members of the CDC. They go into private industry, and they work in non-governmental organizations like the World Health Organization or the Gates Foundation or others like that. We have a number of ongoing projects where support would allow the continuation of research that would otherwise get paused or have to stop because of loss of funding. One of those projects is to try to understand the impact of different mutations on drug resistance in gonorrhea and to try to understand ways to forestall the appearance of those mutations and to keep them from spreading by the way that we use antibiotic drugs. That's work led by my colleague, Yonatan Grad. Another set of research that I lead with my colleague, Bill Hanage, looks at the ways that our vaccines against pneumonia change the population of bacteria and how we can use those vaccines to most effectively reduce the prevalence of the bad ones and that cause the most disease, because these are special vaccines that target certain strains but not others. A third line of work is really trying to figure out what's the future of COVID-19. The question here is, does it become another seasonal disease like influenza? Does it depend more on whether the new variants continue to arise and how they spread? Or does it depend on variations in the weather and other factors that are more familiar with other respiratory diseases? Understanding that will allow us to use our vaccines better to help answer questions like you asked earlier, Sam, about whether you need a new vaccine every year or whether you can go for several years without one. And otherwise to understand what this new disease is going to do to our population. So those are some of the types of work that are underway at our place, all of which are threatened or paused, in fact, by funding cuts. I'd also mention the really excellent work done by our colleagues at the Harvard Botswana Project, Roger Shapiro and Shaheen Lachman, who have been working, as I mentioned earlier, with people in Botswana, with hundreds of scientists there. They're training African scientists to make the next discoveries, as they did with the Omicron variant of SARS-CoV-2, and to become health scientists who can build capacity in their own country to prevent and respond to infectious diseases like HIV and the things that will come next. That's been a very, very hard hit program in the funding cuts, and one that's done tremendous valuable work and would benefit from any generosity that people have.
Nice. Well, again, thank you for everything you're doing, Mark, and thanks for the education here on the podcast. I hope people will support your work and also the Botswana Project, and we'll get links to both of those in the show notes. So thanks again.
Sounds great. Okay. Thanks.